Evident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. It's so nice to have you with us this evening on this, now July the 7th, still on the West Coast, July the 8th, 2009, on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. Well, I just got off of, about an hour ago, an hour interview with Jeff Rentz on his show, and it was a very interesting show, and we may touch upon some of the topics that we discussed. If we, by any chance, picked up any new listeners from his show, welcome to the broadcast, as well as those of you around the world, especially in the U.S. military, at the many, many military bases scattered around this globe. I had the opportunity to discuss some things that have been going on over the past year or so. In fact, it's been at least a year or more that I was on Jeff's show, so I was updating him about many of the issues that my listeners here on Evident Footprints are quite familiar with. And believe it or not, he was surprised about some of these things. I'm even considering trying to get Jeff on this show because he's not only is he a legend in internet radio, he is a true patriot, an excellent journalist. He's got one of the top websites in the world, and he's also a prolific researcher and reader of many people's work, and he's very supportive of not just what I'm doing, but others like me out there. And so we're looking probably next month, if I can twist his arm a little bit, to get him on this show. I'm sure you'll find him to be very entertaining, very informative, and just a fantastic radio voice. And tonight we've got another great radio voice. This gentleman is my publisher and editor at the Idaho Observer, and he at one time had his own radio show with his better half, Ingrid Castle, on Republic Broadcasting Network. Things got rather busy for him, and he had to devote much more time to the pressing issues that not just publishers and editors have to deal with, but journalists. He's also a prolific writer in his own right and a great researcher. He's taught me many things, some of the tricks of the trade, you could say. And we've become quite good friends, even though we've never personally met and shook hands. So with that, I invite back again to Evident Footprints my very dear friend, my publisher and editor at the Idaho Observer, Don Harkins. Don, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Don. You know, it's true. We have never met in person, but there is some things that transcend those kinds of social bonds. And I think our decision to pursue truth and to let it take us wherever we're led is a bond that is greater than, in many cases, blood.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true, and I agree with you. Of course, you're agreeing with my statement, so I would be a fool if I didn't agree with what you just said.
Yeah, disagree with me, John. Yeah, it's in your best interest.
What is it? If A equals B and B equals C, then A equals C?
Yeah, logic is really funny that way, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, what comes to mind is that... as you were speaking, I'm picturing how I fit into your immense stable of writers, and you have some of the most prolific writers in the world who have been featured, or whose work have been featured on in your paper and on your Idaho Observer website. And I've gone back, believe it or not, into many issues of the Observer to just get a feel for how the paper has transformed over the years and how you have always been on top of the issue of the day. That's the thing I notice most, is that it's cutting-edge reporting regardless of who the author is. And I see myself as somewhat of an aberration in terms of my approach to researching, my approach to putting a story together, and I well appreciate the standard way of writing, and yet when I research, and I think you'd probably agree to some extent, the way my stories have to be pieced together, I have to literally find the thread and the needle that ties facts together. It's not your normal kind of research, as you well know, and it's difficult to piece these things together. Somehow I get lucky, I think, in the end.
Well, no, you've kind of hit on a model of research that is really important, with the understanding that we live in a world today that is very fluid, that is also wrought with all sorts of things that just don't jive with our "all men are created equal, anyone can be president" mantra that has been sewn into our understanding of life. You hit on something that kind of twists all of that, because the matrix of all of this stuff, not just in this country but globally as well, is the families. There are certain families on the planet that have a lot of sway, both politically and materially. Politically, they have a lot of power. Materially, they have a lot of wealth. And where did these guys come from? The tendency is for us to take for granted the mainstream media reports that these guys are here and they're individuals, and through their own accolades and advantages in life or their capabilities, they are able to ascend to certain positions that are suddenly now interesting to us, topically and chronologically. But the truth is that these guys are from families, and you've hit on this model of research that allows us to chart these families when they entered the country, because prior to the turn of the last century, everybody showed up here by ship. And when you take a good look at the familial relationships of the guys that are in power now, the people who are in the news now, the people who are shaping policy now, you see that they come from families that entered this country at a certain time, and that those people have very, very questionable issues surrounding them coming into the country. So the birthplace of these guys and their ascension to power in this country takes on a really interesting angle when you begin to look at who they are, where they are from, and the anomalies that are axiomatic with all of them being in our face today.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm often asked the question, and I guess all of this is going to be a prelude to what we're talking about, because we're going to use sort of the same technique, my research model, to move along our conversation. I think you sense that every time you and I talk. I'm going to lead you down this crazy path, but in the end, we get to the destination, don't we?
Well, eventually, and if anything, we end up with more questions than we have answers.
Yeah. I would preface all of these statements we're about to make with just a quick review of my research background, in that through my world travels as a musician and a musical performer, composer, arranger, orchestrator, producer, and just someone that loves life and was really turned on by the prospect of seeing other civilizations around the world and spending time living in other countries and learning the languages and respecting the customs of the people and learning to communicate with the people, I saw immediately the difference between government and actually being amongst the regular people. It's like when you go on a vacation and you might go camping or skiing or something, and you're around people that are sharing a common interest, and so you get into each other, you get into life, and it's a pleasant experience, and life could really be that way all the time. And I always questioned why it wasn't. So I began studying many, many things as just out of my general interest in understanding what my life's purpose was. I always saw it being heavily involved in music, but I also saw it morphing into something else, and I guess it's what I'm doing now. That's quite clear. I'm a journalist of sorts, and you have made that possible. I would be a journalist in some way, but I you know, my first shot at publication was with you. I didn't attempt to approach any other newspapers prior to our first conversation, and I've grown, and I think in some ways you have too. We've found things to do outside the box, in a sense. And we're always thinking outside the box now. I think once you see what it looks like from outside the box, you have to create a new life outside the box. And so we're attempting to do that every day of the week, 365 days a year. And in our pursuit of discovering the truth and sharing that truth with others, it puts us through a lot of gyrations. And we keep seeing these things occurring on the side now. It's like watching a sideshow almost. A sideshow where they're demanding we buy tickets and they're demanding we sit there and watch their performance as if it's something to be beholden of, as if they are equal or greater than God. So in the nutshell, you know, that's sort of what my research model sprung out of, is my understanding of the world religions, my understanding of metaphysics, certainly my understanding of communication through music, my understanding of art, my appreciation for all of these things as well. And I have interests in lots of areas, but it was when I approached you was when that signal, that alarm went off. It's time to come out with what I know. And it's an ever expanding process. I don't profess to know everything, but I know a lot about a lot of things. And so I've been able to tie those things together with someone like you and Ingrid, who are very similar in your backgrounds. Maybe not parallel in that sense, but certainly you've been exposed to lots of things. You're very open-minded, and you're willing to consider the truth at all steps of your journey.
Well, it's interesting you'd say that. My blood family has always, since I was very young, felt that I was, I think the term would be fickle, in that I can believe something one day and then do an about-face and believe something different another day. And at first, when I was younger, of course, that was kind of problematic, and I questioned myself, but as I've gotten older and I've experienced many things, I see that it's really all been just a process of learning new things and not being afraid to change my worldview based upon new and compelling information. And that does put us in an interesting category of folks that is rather small in demographica, because most people are so concerned about other people's perceptions of how smart or stupid they are that they won't change their minds even with new and compelling information, because that would require them to admit that they were stupid at one time and they're smarter now. And I have just apparently never, even when I was a little kid, felt that way. I've always been plenty, I guess, secure in my intellect. I'm not a brilliant fellow, but I'm a smart enough guy. And when new information comes my way, I am interested in and completely capable of changing my understanding of it. And to be quite honest, the more harshly a new belief treats an old belief of mine, the more interested I am in changing it. And that is just anathema to most people, mm-hmm. who are generally, at the very base level, very concerned about what other people think of how smart or stupid they are. And to be, I don't know, when we make a mistake in the paper, say, and it requires a retraction, I am overjoyed to do it. And what people should really begin to understand is that the more you question your own self, the more respect others have for you. So you're actually doing yourself a favor by changing in midstream based on new and compelling information, admitting the wrongs of the past, and going forward on new information.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish that more people would adopt that position, because it's very, well, it's very humbling, for one, but it's also something that instills confidence in others that you are actually seeking truth.
Yes. Now, you made a statement about education, which I probably could, I mean, it was very succinct. You described the dilemma of public education, and probably private education as well.
Yes.
In terms of, yeah, the organizational structure. I'm speaking of officialdom. In other words, you described the pitfall of education, in that one achieves a certain level of intelligence, and the expansion stops there. And that is the dilemma, that people would feel that another has become or is becoming smarter than another person. That's the insecurity brought about through the belief system and this control matrix. There's no other explanation for it. The denial that comes up in someone having to face the fact that they may be wrong about something. And I'll use myself as an example, something that you pointed out when you published part 6 of my Three Stooges article series, and you pointed out that picture that I thought was taken in Lebanon at least represents Lebanon. All the data that supports my conclusion that was at Notre Dame de Jamour in Beirut is partially correct in the uniform that Stanley Ann Dunham is supposedly, or let's say the alleged Stanley Ann Dunham is wearing. That would have had to occur somewhere where they have a school. Now, at the time, it would have been Beirut, or it would have been in Canada. Those are the two possibilities for that period. So I can say, on the basis of the information that I had at the time, that was an accurate statement, but I went on to debunk all the photos as being fraudulent. So it really doesn't matter where I thought it was. it's an artificial photo. It's a total fraud, you see. So I'm willing to admit that. In fact, I think the whole article sort of points that out. And those are the things that we have to be able to quickly make choices upon when we discover the truth. And that particular photo that I misread as having been from a place was implied to represent some place. And the actuality is those three people weren't even in that photo together physically, like any of us take a photograph of our families. It's been constructed on someone's computer as if you were making some kind of artifact on a workbench using flowers and a piece of wood and some glue. That's basically what they did with those photos. Now, that is a difficult concept for people to grasp, and yet everything in our reality is like this today, especially through the media, the mainstream media, television being probably the worst culprit, because they use all of the sensory tools to affect the psychology of the viewers on every possible level we can describe. And that sort of segues into the topic you and I were going to discuss tonight. But I want to offer you, an opportunity to respond to what I just said.
Well, it's true. I mean, we are now reeling with the reality that this person who is now occupying the Oval Office is a fraud, and on a multitude of levels. The birth certificate thing just really kind of is just the beginning. and the manner in which somebody or some bodies have gone to create and maintain this illusion is rather extreme. And what you have done with all of the photos that are offered to the public as some kind of assurance that this guy is who he says he is, when you look at them closely, you find that they're fraudulent. And I come from a certain degree of expertise in this area because I've been working in PageMaker and InDesign doing page layout for 15 years. And a corollary to that is the other Aldus program, which is Photoshop. And I know myself, having been puzzling over this process of improving the reprographics of pictures that I put in an Idaho Observer newspaper, that there are certain stresses that you can apply to photographs to attain certain results. And when you apply some of these stresses to any, just pick one, I challenge the listening audience to go to any photograph. They don't have to pull it off of your website. They can just go to the web and say Obama, and you'll get a variety of photographs of this guy, his life, allegedly, his folks, his grandparents, and everybody around him, and you get this set of photographs that supposedly determine, in your mind, where he was, who he is, and why he deserves to be president. And if you apply any of the Photoshop rules to these photographs, if you use any of the commands, if you stress any of these photographs, you find them all consistent in one way, and that is that they're all fraud. Every single one of them. And you can find by applying the Photoshop commands to the colors, the intensities of certain things, you find that, one, the pixels don't match up because they are generated from different programs at different times in their development, and you find that shadows are different, you find proportions different, you find all sorts of things that indicate in about a 3 or less minute lesson that the photographs of Barack Hussein Obama, if that is his real name, are bogus.
Yes. Now,
bogus.
Yes, keeping that in. Now, you're just confirming what I'm saying, and the listening audience could say, well, this guy has a vested interest. After all, to some extent, he's publishing the work of this man who's interviewing him. So he has to support what he's saying, but I'm supported by other researchers out there, and the public, the general public, is not attacking me. It's quite evident that this is what has been done. Now, wouldn't it be wonderful if someone in the mainstream media somehow got the courage to tell the truth and to reveal this to the world? What do you think would happen?
Well, I don't know, because it would be an even sort of expose, because you also did the same thing to the Bush family. So we've got a Democrat black guy that you're trashing, and you have a Republican white guy that you're trashing. So you're sort of a equilateral, universal, equal opportunity trasher.
Well, I trashed McCain. I actually trashed two
and
white
McCain
guys
as well, and
yeah.
And Hillary also.
Hillary's on the way. Yes.
She's not done. She's a bigger player in all of this than most people give her credit for.
Now there is an aspect, and I have written about this in part 7, okay? And I, you know, it's an overview of the Hegelian dialectic. Now, George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, who the Hegelian dialectic is accredited to, came up with this philosophical, or what you could call a philosophical dialectical concept. In other words, you can present something in one way and propose that an opposite or alternative event is a is a counter to that event, and then you can cause people to dispute over which one is real. That's the general simplified version of what Hegelian dialectic is. It's two opposing views or two separated views that cause dissension amongst the people. And it causes those people to focus their attention on purely those two events. Now, enter Karl Marx. Marx took the Hegelian dialectic and added a third dimension to it, which he saw as a dialectical materialism event, or as a dialectical materialist events opposing each other. In other words, there weren't psychological or spiritual concepts necessarily looked at from a philosophical point of view, but he literally applied actions or situations or things to these opposing concepts and added a third dimension. So it would be like the Nazis attacking Russia and blaming it on England. Then the English or the British attacking, or let's say the Nazis attacking England and blaming it on the Russians. Meanwhile, they were the ones that did the attacking, and they carry on with about their agenda while everyone's arguing over who started the whole thing, you see? This is exactly what's going on with the Obama story. And when I began to see this, because they kept promoting, these people all studied Marx, they're communists, they're named and quoted in the communist publications that came out of Chicago ever since Barack Obama came into the picture. And you have to ask yourself, who is behind the scenes orchestrating this whole thing? That's the Marxian aspect of this whole thing. And in you'll remember what I told you in the very beginning, and we're not going to reveal that on the show tonight, but you distinctly remember where and in a general sense, who I felt was the power behind this on a money level and on an influence level. And I've come to the an indisputable a position or conclusion now as to who the real family is, or the force behind Obama. And it's not Hawaii, and it's not Kenya. And really, we have this happening to us all over the place, don't we? In terms of my historical research and the fine research of many other prolific authors and journalists, they're seeing the writing on the wall, that they're telling us this and they're doing that. Another example would be this mantra that they're spreading democracy throughout the world, and they want to ensure that Iraq and Afghanistan are not run by dictators, even though the government set up the dictatorships for these countries, you see? And they funded the dictatorships, and they funded the wars that have occurred in these areas. And then they call it terrorism, and they fund the terrorism. They create the terrorist organizations. This is the Hegelian dialectic, according to Karl Marx, that we're witnessing. Now, what are we talking about? Fascism, communism, socialism, all wrapped up into one package. And people call it different names. Oh, no, it can't be Nazism or fascism, because the Nazis ended when Hitler died. But they disregard the fact that there is proof, there's substantial evidence that Hitler lived, you see, well beyond World War II, and was even in America. So, but this already takes it outside the box so far that people are just, they just shut it off. They can't conceive that this would have been done to us and our government would have lied, because they don't understand who's pulling the strings, you see. There are so many dimensions to this, and yet, you know, we are exposing that, aren't we?
Well, I think so. There's a broadening cross-section of people who are listening. I think the current economic climate is really creating an environment where people are going to be a lot more open to what we have to say to them. And so people are kind of waking up in a way that is larger than any time in the last 15 years of my dissident life. And hopefully people are going to be able to see that we have in power a bunch of people who don't, one, belong there, and two, are operating to our negative interest.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'd like to shift gears just a moment, because this is pertinent to what's going on today. You have to ask yourself why there's so much attention being given to the death of Michael Jackson. I mean, he pretty much, once he left the country and headed for the United Arab Emirates to sort of get away from people after his trial for child molestation charges and pedophilia, you have to ask yourself why that came about, why he disappeared, and then why all of a sudden he died, and the media has played ping pong with these two aspects of his career, his success in the music world, without really giving enough credit to those who supported him, you know, the Quincy Joneses of the world, let's say, and all the great studio musicians that played the music that he sang to. And I wonder even if he wrote all the songs that he performed, or the majority of them. I would say many that he penned his name to, he didn't write. Just because I don't see, as a musician, I don't see the continuity, the development of the artist in that sense. I don't intend to make fun of his passing, yet you have to say that was one complex individual, and the transformations that occurred in stages seem to represent something which has manifested into the circus that's taken place over the last 11 days, and what it's done to the public's consciousness in terms of ignoring the important things going on in the world. It's outrageous that people paid $100,000 for a ticket to sit in the Staples Center to attend his funeral. Everything has been turned into a commercial venture with this guy. Even his passing has become that. I'd like you to comment on that.
Well, for one, I remember when Princess Diana died, and actually a lot of evidence has accumulated since that time to suggest that she was killed. But when her memorial took place and her funeral, and there was a certain global media attention paid to it, and what Michael Jackson has experienced, what the world has experienced with the passage of this gentleman has been really not very diminished over what the world experienced when Princess Diana was memorialized. And that kind of makes me think that there is a lot to this guy, who is not that much older than myself. I think he just turned 50 and I'm 46. I grew up with Ben. I remember Thriller. I remember him, you know, growing up. And I remember also when he was a black kid, and then I remember suddenly he's this weird, twisted, whitish-looking fellow. And so a lot of things happened in his life that none of us know anything about, and yet we see the public depiction of that. And one of the main public aspects of this guy's life is the Neverland Ranch, his place in Encino, California, where he lived for a long time. And these allegations of his relationships with children that, though he was never convicted of it, really indicate systematic and obsessive pedophilia. And for this guy to be given the kind of attention that he is being given after his death is an indication of, I don't know a better word for it or a term, is a psychological operation. This morning, I hardly ever watch television, but circumstances had me wake up to CNN and all the regular media news outlets, and there was no other news this morning. The only news today was the fact that Michael Jackson was dead, and today was memorial, and there was tremendous security. Miles and miles of roads blocked off so that his family could have their private thing, and all this other security around all of those who would end up attending his memorial. Why the security? Why the hype? Why is it that the world stands still today for a really weird freak of a man who hadn't produced an album in 18 years and his death? What is really going on? And the overriding thing in my mind is that here's a guy who is notorious. If you were to ask anybody whether they thought he was taking sexual liberties with small children the last several years, they would say yes. And yet, the world is watching his funeral, is celebrating this guy, the king of pop, and his death. And it's just completely, it just doesn't make sense in the sense that he's a public figure, which he has really not been except in these horrible ways for a long time. And he was a musician that had a lot of talent, but he's not a lot different than many, many, many other people who are extremely talented as well. So what is the purpose of the circus that we've seen today? The circus that we've seen over the last couple of years with his strange developments as a black guy turned white guy, as a strange guy who loves children but never molests them, but although a lot of people think he does. You know, what is really going on here? And what is the diversion that his death is creating? And you know what? I even kind of wonder whether this guy, again, growing up with Michael Jackson, I had the album Ben when I was a kid, and I saw the Jackson 5 a lot on TV and stuff, and I had a perception of him. What happened to where this guy turns into a physiological freak who is, according to his autopsy, 120 pounds, 5'9", and completely bald in every part of his body? Now, what? Who is this person? When did he change? And I'm kind of struggling with that myself, because I remember in about 1982 and 83, he had the Thriller album out. He was still a black guy. A couple years later, he comes out and he's this white guy. I am not completely convinced that the Michael Jackson that has been depicted as Michael Jackson throughout the last 20 years of freakishness is the same guy that I grew up with. I'm just not completely convinced.
Oh, I can tell you, and I agree wholeheartedly with what you're saying. I can tell you from a musical standpoint that at the time these physical changes were taking place, the artistic qualities, the artistic characteristics, you know, a person has a voice and they develop this voice over a period of time. And I studied with a vocal coach, Robert Salon, who had taught Michael Jackson from basically from the time the Jacksons moved to Los Angeles from the Gary, Indiana area after having signed with Motown Records and Berry Gordy. And this change, this transformation began around the time of the creation of the production, The Wiz, if you remember that. He started looking like this new character in that series. He had a pointier nose. His skin tone had changed, almost like someone. He changed from a handsome young man, a black man, but handsome. There was nothing repulsive about his appearance. To like you said, something starting to become rather freakish, and he always looked like he had on makeup. And he, in the end, in my estimation, I mean, this is just my opinion, but somebody would think he was dumped into a barrel full of flour. He was that parched. Even he didn't look Caucasian. And he made statements. These are recorded on film. I saw one yesterday where he flat out said, I'm not a child molester, and I don't bleach my skin. Okay, so this is a disease that was progressive. Now, it changed the shape of his nose, shrunk it, made it look like it was falling off, changed the complete shape of his eyes. I'm not talking about droopiness or sagginess underneath the eyelids or the eyeballs, I should say, or it was everything. It was like he had permanent makeup. You know how girls get this permanent mascara. It's almost like getting a tattoo. They don't have to mess around with eyeliner and mascara. It's permanent. He had these changes that even women don't make to their visage. And equally, in terms of music, he made the same abrupt changes to where I'd have to say, that's not the same voice. That's not the same singing style. He started letting out these squeaks and grunts and groans and doing obscene things like grabbing his crotch. That became acceptable to the public. It was okay for Michael Jackson to do this, but anyone doing this on TV and the TV network was fined, you know, large amounts of money. And this little stunt they pulled with Janet Jackson at the Super Bowl a few years ago, and Justin Timberlake ripping at her clothing and exposing her bare breast on live TV. You see, these are psyops. Those things don't happen by accident. That was not an accident. And they certainly could have edited out of a major worldwide television broadcast. They were sending a message to people. They were conditioning for us to accept things that were so abnormal that by the time we got back to our everyday reality, they could pull their next stunt on us. And I see Michael Jackson's passing as possibly having been staged to some extent. You know, some say a hit contract, if you want to call it that, because there was a whole flurry of people dying. And it seems to still be going on. There are other notable people that have passed away within the last few days under really strange circumstances. It's like they're preparing us for something that's about to happen. And I sense in a way that they're going to pull some kind of stunt that's going to create a race war.
Well, obviously, in this country, there's been a lot of racial issues that have been part of congressional acts that have really kind of stressed the tension in this country. And the quote, Mexican invasion is one of them. And I would have to say, even today, and I am one of the least, say, racist and bigoted people you would ever meet. I accept all people on the basis of how they treat me or how they treat the world around them. I'm an individualist. I'm very interested in how people are and how they behave, and I judge them, if that's my job or my prerogative, accordingly. But here in little old Spirit Lake, Idaho, just today, a black man was getting a post office box. He may be the first one in history, and I'm not kidding. And also, in our little community here in North Idaho in the Panhandle, population, we have one blinking light. We are equidistant, about 40 minutes from Sandpoint, Idaho, and 40 minutes from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. We have a growing Mexican contingent, and that's never happened before. And so we see these things happening, and we see a lot of manipulation on the political end of things for all of these things to be happening.
Mm-hmm.
And with regard to Michael, one can't help but think that it's a little bit like this gentleman that we know as Barack Obama. we know because we've been studying it, because we've been following you, and because your listeners have been following you, that the likelihood that this guy is an American is almost zero. The likelihood that he's even Kenyan is almost zero. There's
a minus zero. That's a minus zero.
And so, but people of color in this country, and when I say color, there's white people, and then there's all the other shades of skin that have a tendency to want to identify with Barack Obama because it's a show that the white age of domination in the land of the free is coming to an end. That a man of color can assume the Oval Office and has indeed, for, you know, argument's sake, for the first time, done so. And if we contradict, if we complain, if we suspect that he's anything other than who he says he is, our reasons for doing so are purely racist. They aren't based on the facts. And this issue with Michael Jackson as well. This is a guy that grew up in the Jackson family, obviously a very notable musical family, the Jackson Five, black, Afro-American, Motown, and so he transitioned into whiteness because he had a disease of some kind. But if we decide that we're going to chastise him for his proclivity to pedophilia, if we do anything to besmirch his name, it's because we're racist. And so we do have, in this strange media-driven sense, this huge race war building. And I kind of, although I don't know yet because it hasn't happened, I do suspect that you are correct in that this event, not the death of Michael Jackson, but the memorialization of Michael Jackson, is taking huge strides in the race war effort that you've so well described.
Yes, and in other words, we're to accept this man as a black man and a white man, as if it's symbolic of accepting Barack Obama as a black man and a white man. And I have not a hair on my body that is racist. And my friends will tell you that. I've never made a racist remark to my black friends or my Chinese friends or my Japanese friends or my Mexican or Puerto Rican friends. I know people of color around the world. And the common bond that we have is our love of music and our love of the truth and our appreciation for our differences as much as our likes and dislikes. And I sense that this is a diversion, number one, from reality, the everyday reality of the corruption stuff. And it's also a psychological acceptance or let's say condoning of the pedophilia that goes on in Washington. It's rampant in Washington amongst the politicians. And so if we can accept Michael Jackson as an alleged pedophile, then we should accept the politicians as alleged pedophiles as well. And it's symbolic. I'm not saying that's any way inclusive of what's going on here at all. I sense an event coming, and I'm not alone in this. I sense an event coming that is going to attempt to divide people on a racial basis. And you know, I reach out every day to all of my friends of all races, and I have no idea the racial makeup of my listening audience, but if I'm told that there are millions of people around the world, I presume that there are people of all races listening to this show. And I have nothing against anyone because they come from a certain racial background. My issue with Barack Obama or any other political figure who has lied about who they are and where they're from is that very fact. Has nothing to do with the color of their skin. It's about the truth, and it's about the hoops that our ancestors had to jump through to create a life here in this country. And this guy has been given a silver spoon from birth by those that raised him and those that conceived him. And if you speak to Larry Sinclair, he's using that spoon for other purposes right now.
Yes. No, it is something. These issues are not racially driven. Excuse me. The way you and I perceive them are not racially driven. However, the guys at the high end who are manipulating stuff, they seem to be very racially aware and racially centric.
Yes. Yes, there is something there. Now, we could speculate on the metaphysical aspects of this, and I by no means intend to take you down that road, although I know you're quite capable of talking about that as well. Give us some perceptions, if you could, in the nutshell, and this is difficult to do, on the radio, with words, just out of the clear blue sky. Or the chemtrail-laden skies.
Or clear white skies, you mean?
Yeah, yeah. What is going on in the world? You know, we've got Obama in Russia today, and you know what the crux of his visit to Russia has been? His daughter wearing a trench coat looking like a KGB agent. That was on CNN this evening. Literally, he's joking about it, and I think he was even able to crack a joke without a teleprompter, which I find interesting. the world is crumbling. Let me say that. And we know about the corruption, and they're trying their best to put a Band-Aid on it, while they continue to further the corruption, mind you, so these events that we've been talking about, like this Jackson funeral and all this stuff, are just distractions to keep our minds off of what's really going on. And I would add also that it's reinforcement of this idol worship. This is all based on idol. I mean, my God, they came out with a talent contest and called it American Idol. They have the same thing going on in Europe. They have British Idol as well. So they're promoting idolatry, which is in the face of Christianity. They're trying to destroy the Christian faith, and they're doing a pretty good job of it. And you have Christians who are oblivious to the fact that that's going on, because they just think that they're going to be picked up in a cloud and taken somewhere else. And whether that's true or not, they're not dealing with issues. They're not facing the issues prevalent here. You, in your work, are faced with these things nonstop all day long. People are coming to you with stories. What do you sense is going on with on the basis of what you've published over the years and what you see happening now? What is your deepest sense telling you is happening?
Boy, that's really loaded, especially since I'm coming to some realizations lately that are going to be very difficult to explain on my end and difficult to accept in the hearts and minds of others, because we are us, you, me, and everybody who is listening, not in creation. We are the products of fiction. And this goes back for so many years. And when you think about it, at a very logical level, which, by the way, logic would be a fiction as well, we are, ever since we picked up a pencil, ever since we saved a seed from the fall to plant in the spring, we've been operating in fiction. And our parents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, all the way back ad infinitum, are believing things and going forward on truths that are really not a part of creation in a logical sense. So everything that we're discussing now is an outgrowth of fiction. And we had in the paper last month, it was the May edition of the paper, on page 22, a guy wrote, his name is Al Thompson, a prisoner, wrote, "How do we come to be such idiots?" And within the Christian perspective, the first idiot would be Satan because he challenged God. What an idiot. And so what did Satan do? He challenged not just God, really, but creation. And he wanted, within the Christian perspective, to improve upon creation to make a more paradisical existence for man, even if it were at the expense of everything else on the planet. And so your question is really deepened by the fact that I'm beginning to wonder exactly what is creation and what is fiction. And when we're talking on this phone, using this medium, discussing the things we are, name one aspect of what we've discussed here that isn't fiction. There really isn't anything that we've discussed so far that can't be categorized as fiction. And so how do we reconcile God's universe, which is creation, with the fiction that we're existing in, the fiction that we're attempting to describe and navigate? And then we take a look at this insane fiction that we're dealing with today. If you're to open up the news and look at the, I guess, memorialization of Michael Jackson, it is quintessential fiction. And so much of what we're dealing with is that. And it's really a progression of events that goes back thousands and thousands of years, 10,000 years perhaps, and I'm just, you know, using that term, that 10,000 year figure, just for conversation, because I don't know exactly when it began and where it's ending. But we are struggling at this time to deal with a set of circumstances that is the result of an unbroken chain of events going back prior to the birth of Christ, probably going all the way back to Babylon, and trying to make rhyme or reason of it. And it's very, very difficult to do so. And when we do attempt to make rhyme or reason of it, what are we doing but citing the fictional stuff that we've been conditioned to believe is true as an explanation for what's happening? So the conundrum that we're in the middle of here is rather extreme, and the entire world is at war as a result. The entire global economy is in trouble as a result. All the different races in the world are being pitted against one another as a result. Indeed, all the religions of the world, the major ones anyway, Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, are at odds with one another, and Hinduism are at odds with one another. And so we are in a world of fiction that is at odds with itself in fiction, and the creation aspect of our lives, which is the breathing, breeding, living, and loving aspect of ourselves, is really at odds with all of the above.
Mm-hmm. Now, in essence, you've just summarized my explanation of Karl Marx's interpretation of the Hegelian dialectic. It's all a materialist or a physical manifestation, and really the reason they hammer away on the physical, the appearances and the look and the sound and not so much the feel in a spiritual sense, but the physical sensations that these different experiences create, and they're all fear-based. If we were to apply Marx's theory and include, or Marx's practice of the Hegelian dialectic, and get outside the box and start making our own choices and taking responsibilities for ourselves, we will come into the spiritual recognition of who we really are. See, all these things are designed to cut us off from the reality of who we are. And it's all done through fiction or illusion.
You're correct. And there are so many different ways. If you were to perceive the ideal manner in which you, myself, and every other child were to be born into this planet, there would be a mother who is happy and in love and nutritionally taken care of, living in a stress-free and clean environment, so that when we were born, we would be imbued with all the energies of creation without any of the toxins and without any of the stresses of our modern life. But what happens instead is that kids are born into hospitals with people with latex gloves under fluorescent lights, to men who don't have a clue how the body works and can only apply allopathic remedies to things that are problematic. And it's a huge business, and a baby can be born costing 50 cents or $18,000 or $19,000 or $30,000. And in the corporate universe, wherein the fiction, wherein most people are born these days, the $30,000 option is what everybody involved in the birth is after, not the most pristine, loving environment that would produce the best child with the greatest hope for realizing his own potential.
Mm-hmm. Well said, and I agree with what you just said. Well, we're coming upon the closing moments of the show here. I do want to take advantage of the fact that you're on tonight in light of things coming down the pike. This mandatory vaccine thing that they're talking about. And I just want to preface my remark by saying that, your wife, Ingrid, will be on the show on the 21st, which is 2 weeks from today. And I intend to go into this topic, with her in great depth, but, I'd like you to give your thoughts on the concept. Now, I've heard that these three mandatory, they're intending to make mandatory vaccines, to stem this so-called pandemic that they're beating the, media drums to, ingrain into the subconscious of a fear-laden populace around the world. It's all concocted. It's all a big ruse. As you said, it's a fiction. And the information has come out that the three stages of vaccine represent the method in which this will wipe out humanity in terms of those that get these vaccinations. Vaccination number one is supposed to shut down the immune system. And you correct me if I'm wrong or if you have some information about this. Vaccine number two will be the actual disease or diseases. And vaccination number three will be the restart or the, let's say, the kickstart, the return of the immune system back into function. But on the basis of the immune system having been shut down and then bombarded with all of these toxins, these diseases, when the immune system refires with the third vaccine, it's going to implode the insides of who's ever gotten this series of shots. Do you have any information on that to corroborate what I just said? Hopefully I was succinct enough that you can understand this progression.
Well, I've heard what you've said, and I'm not doubting the veracity of that, but it's theory. One of the things that is not theory, however, is that we've been covering in the Outer Observer the building, the progress of the global pandemic preparedness machinery.
Yes.
And it is such a machine. I'm going to go ahead and switch gears just a moment to give another example. Example is the Comprehensive Energy Reform Act or whatever the Congress just passed. It is top heavy with the understanding that global warming exists. There's gazillions of scientists who would say that global warming doesn't exist. And I am under the impression that global warming is merely a cover for the chemical poisoning of the planet. That being said, since 1987 in the Montreal Protocols, it's been accepted by the governments of the world that global warming exists. And since that time, tremendous industries have been funded, have been financed, have been building in order to globally address this issue of global warming. And even if it's a fraud, it doesn't matter. Congress decided that global warming exists and that all this inertia, all this energy that's gone towards the building of all these industries to deal with global warming lobby heavily, and we have global warming, we have a global warming bill, we have global warming policy, we have global warming everything coming down the pike. And with regard to the pandemic preparedness stuff, it's identical. Since the swine flu fiasco of the 70s, 1977, I think, there has been global pandemic preparedness machinery going forward, regardless that the swine flu thing was a manufactured event, that it was lab created and that the government was quite aware of it. Its response was pandemic preparedness, mass vaccination, and they learned a lot from that. It was a fiasco. But since that time, all of this stuff has been building. If you take a look at the paramilitarization of even the medical industry in this country, you will see that a lot of enforcement capability is bestowed upon these people. I mean, they're just doctors. They're in lab coats and white outfits and stuff, and they don't carry guns, but they have tremendous police powers at their beck and call. And as this pandemic preparedness machinery has been growing, a lot of people have been instructed in certain modalities, certain understandings of the way things are, and first responders, the medical community, the public health community, all these guys are heavily, heavily involved in going forward with pandemic preparedness. And I am convinced that at the end of March last year, or this year, when the pandemic preparedness machinery was triggered, that it created a machine that is not stopping. And even if the swine flu stuff has disappeared a bit from the headlines, these guys are still going forward. The machinery is going forward. And I am completely of the mind that the CDC, the World Health Organization, and all these guys are going to have their global pandemic whether there's an illness or not.
Yeah.
So your synopsis of what these vaccines are going to do in that perspective is completely correct. It doesn't matter whether or not swine flu, you know, the stuff that they're calling swine flu, which they can't produce, by the way. There is no evidence of a swine flu. There's just claims that there is one. There's no scientific proof of a particular pathogen that creates a set of deadly circumstances. And so even in the absence of that, they are going forward and there will be a pandemic. In fact, the Southern Hemisphere right now is in its, say, winter state, and it's cold and flu season, and there is a lot of vaccine being delivered at this time. And I suspect that it's in preparation for it circulating to the Northern Hemisphere for this cold and flu season, and they're hoping beyond hope that they're going to be able to make a whole bunch of people really sick so that they can begin initiating this martial scenario based upon a public health emergency.
Mm-hmm. Now, I agree with you that there is no swine flu, but I would also add to that there are swine, and they are in Washington.
Yeah.
D.C.
There's no shortage of swine, although I think that it's really horrible of us to be so arrogant and presumptuous to attach porcine qualities to human behavior. It's like calling a court a kangaroo court.
Yeah.
I don't believe that kangaroos are capable of that kind of...
Yeah, subversion. Well, yeah, of course, I'm using a metaphor, but...
Yeah, I know. I had to check you on that, though, Don.
What comes to mind is, okay, they create this law that people have to take these vaccines, and there will be consequences if you don't take the vaccines. That, to me, is tantamount to them creating a law that anyone that doesn't murder their children, you know, all the children in their family below a certain age is guilty of a crime. Are you going to turn around and follow that law? And there is no difference. It doesn't matter if it happens through whatever means one would devise in carrying out the dictates of that law. Is it any different to allow someone else to do that? Because you're complicit in that.
Well, you know, ultimately, if you go back to the creation and fiction argument, there is only creation. And within creation, we have our internal dialogue. This is the thing that keeps us grounded to the world around us. And we don't lie to ourselves. We can't lie to ourselves. We are always grounded to our lives. We're always grounded to our reality. And we always know when we're doing what's right and what's wrong. And so, in the spiritual sense, if we do the wrong thing, even though we think it's for the right reasons, like herd immunity or to keep everybody safe from from these deadly illnesses, then we can justify that in our own minds, but in a spiritual sense, that's not equal to the challenge that's been given to us.
Yes, I agree. Well, we're out of time, Don, but I could go on for a few more hours on this level of conversation.
Yeah, there's no shortage of subject matter here, and there's also no shortage of our desire to, one, find out what's real, truthful in our own lives, but to impart some nuggets of thought and wisdom on others so that they can arrive at some similar conclusions.
Yeah.
We could go on like this forever.
Yeah, the recurring theme that's come out is a frequent theme on the show, and I'm sure my listening audience would agree, and that's that word creation. I've talked about us taking responsibility individually and collectively for what happens on this planet, and we, in doing so, we are going to be faced with many decisions or choices that are not necessarily as palatable as we would like them to be. They are going to be the most difficult decisions, I think, that anyone on this planet has ever had to make in light of what's planned for us by others who really have no right to make those plans for us. And so we're faced with becoming adults and becoming aware, awakened adults. And I see more children actually exemplifying these qualities today than most of the adults. And so we should be nurturing our children, and outside of what Hillary Clinton or Laura Bush would propose we do, you notice we're not hearing this from Michelle Obama. She has other things in mind. We are facing a criminal cabal. We've got to face up to that and take matters into our own hands. And I'm not, promoting violence. I'm a nonviolent person. I'm not promoting the insanity that's going on in government, around the world, and a very small clique of perverted individuals that think they have a special right to enslave the whole population. So that word creation is very important. We've got to reestablish in our minds and in our hearts our connection with God. Do we not?
Yes. I think that's one of the main reasons why we've been able to be subjugated as we have, is because we've been conditioned to believe and have accepted the conditioning that minimizes our relationship to the creative forces of the universe. And we call it God. There's a Christian perspective. There's a variety of different perspectives on that in world history. But ultimately, each one of us is completely responsible for our spiritual walk. And we are obsessed now on the material plane, but I'm completely taken by the belief that any decisions we make in one world, one plane, is got repercussions in the other. So if we make spiritual decisions today, it's going to have repercussions in the material and vice versa.
Okay, well said. Don, I want to thank you for being on tonight's show. Give my best to Ingrid. Tell her I'm looking forward to her interview in 2 weeks on Evident Footprints. We'll be in touch. You know that part 7 is due any day now. And it's going to be
a doozy. I'm bracing myself for that, Don.
Are you? Okay.
Girding my loins, as it were.
You're not the only one. And I'm sure there's some out there on the receiving end that are going to be girding their loins as well. So I want
to
thank you.
This seems to be quite a bit of response to your work is happening in the official camp. So I guess that you're on the mark and you're doing good work, and I'm honored to be a conduit for that.
Well, I'm honored to have you as a friend and my mentor in my journalistic endeavors. And, you know, I appreciate the fact that you're willing to publish what I write and come on the show and talk about that and many, many important issues. So I thank you.
Well, you're welcome. It's my pleasure. And onward into the future, folks. There's a rather uncertain future ahead of us, and all we can do is go forward into it with faith and honor and doing the right thing, because ultimately I believe that's where our futures lie. That's the purpose of our existence, is to rise to the challenges that come to us as we are navigating our lives.
Yes, and I can't end the show without allowing you to tell people how they can subscribe to the Idaho Observer. You do that so well. And I add to that where I have placed the extra copies that I get of the Observer, it seems to grow legs and wings. And though it's intended to stay on the premises so others can read the works there in your publication, some feel that they have to take it with them. And I guess that's a good thing in a way.
I'm honored. And we're kind of a journal for a select group of people in this country who are capable of thinking outside of dogma and going forward independently. And you can contact us by calling 208. The entire state of Idaho is still 208, 255-2307. And you can also write to us if you'd like at P.O. Box 457, Spirit Lake, Idaho, 83869. That's P.O. Box 457, Spirit Lake, Idaho, 83869. And subscription or prescription, depending on what you think the value of our publication is $35 a year, and it comes first class.
Yes, and it comes in pristine condition, I must say, too.
Well, it has to now. We've had a bit of a problem with bulk rate third class, so we've decided not to renew our bulk rate subscription and just go to first class, because it arrives more expeditiously and in better shape.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Don, thank you so much. And folks, you can go to the Idaho Observer website by just typing in idaho-observer.com.
Most of the articles that we've written over the last several years is posted there. We do pretty much stick with what was generated by the IO itself and don't reprint other things that we print. And I do advise highly that you go check us out and see what we've been doing for the last 13 years, but also subscribe to the hard copy publication, because we put most of our energy into that. It's kind of an art project for us every month, and we really do attempt to teach a larger lesson than just the things that happen that we can cover, but also link everything together with a thread that allows people to get really deep insight into what's happening to us.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Don, I have to say goodnight now. Thank you so much for being on Evident Footprints with us tonight, and I look forward to Ingrid's interview. You're welcome if you want to join her, by the way.
Thank you.
You're always welcome, and I look forward to your next appearance, your next scheduled appearance on the show.
Very good, Don. Greetings to you. Salutations to you, and good night to the entire listening audience. It's been a pleasure to be a part of their growth as well as my own.
Okay, good night, Don. Folks, you have been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com and our special guest, Don Harkins of the Idaho Observer. Special thanks go out to Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, Seth Hendrick on the sound, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join us tomorrow evening when my special guest will be former U.S. Marine Corps soldier Drew Raines, who is a talk show host in his own right, and you don't want to miss tomorrow night's show. Lots of good information coming out. To you, the listening audience, thank you for tuning in. I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.